ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You can't control what you don't understand. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm taking back control of my digital life. Join me as I track down my data, lock down my accounts, and learn how to fight back. Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to getting off the internet. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
It's an image you've probably seen a thousand times and not batted an eyelid at.
The classic nativity scene that we see on Christmas cards and that you will see set up inside Catholic churches is a stable-like manger with Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus in a beautiful little hay-like crib, and then a bunch of animals usually. And the essential two animals that we always see is an ox and a donkey.
Even though this image is everywhere, there's something not quite right about it.
This scene that we know and love is not really canonical to the original Bible. There's also been a number of what some scholars would call mistranslations.
So where did it come from? Well, turns out it's all pretty much thanks to one guy. And it's not the guy you're probably thinking of.
St. Francis of Assisi is a very popular saint in the Middle Ages, and he sets up what is thought to be the first kind of nativity play.
My name is Mark Fennell, and this is the tale of how one famously barefoot medieval friar with big theatre kid energy created the nativity scene that we all recognise today. Yes, the one on the cards and the shop windows and church foyer. All him, and no one saw it coming.
I grew up with a very small immediate family and then a very large extended family that we saw, like, you know, every other year kind of thing. So Christmas was sort of either very small or very big and overwhelming. The number one place I would have seen a nativity would have been on a Christmas card.
This is art historian Mary McGillivray.
I kind of had that common thing that I think a lot of like Australian people have of celebrating Christmas, like, you know, religiously with a small R, but having zero connection to the Christian tradition of the festivities. But now as a grown medievalist, I have become, of course, very interested in where these traditions come from.
So the thing with the nativity scene is that it's ubiquitous. It has its iterations. It's been around a very long time, but of course it's not quite what it was originally meant to be, was it?
So the scene of the nativity that we know and love today really comes from the Middle Ages, not from the time of the historical figure of Christ, or indeed the time that the Bible was originally written. So the original version of the nativity comes to us from the books of Matthew and Luke in the canonical books of the Bible, and it's rather vague, actually, on what happens at the birth. We have a story of Mary and Joseph returning to Bethlehem, and scholars of the Bible will, you know, pull this text apart in all which ways, but essentially they're returning to Bethlehem to possibly pay a tax that they have to pay at their place of origin. It's unclear. She's heavily pregnant and she gives birth in some sort of home, perhaps belonging to a relative of Mary's or Joseph's.
Okay, so if you, like me, are carrying the faint but persistent trauma of compulsory scripture class, you probably have some questions here. Firstly, what is with this whole gives birth in a home business? Like, that, I do believe that there was no room in the inn and baby Jesus had to be in a manger.
Historians of the Bible today think that the word manger is potentially a mistranslation. that the original Bible details that Mary and Joseph were staying in a house, not really an inn or a hotel, but more like a home of someone that they knew.
I'm sitting here going, everything I was told in Sunday school is wrong. What?
Not entirely everything, but there was essentially a bit of a mistranslation.
Ah, okay.
From the original texts that mistranslated a word in ancient Hebrew from a word that meant home or house into inn or hotel.
So perhaps there was room in the inn, but they weren't at the inn. They were at somebody's house.
They weren't at the inn. They weren't at the inn. And we have to think about the fact that people in ancient Judea, where the story takes place, lived very differently than how we live today, and indeed how people lived in the Middle Ages when this story got altered quite significantly. There's a brilliant video about this from the historian and scholar of the Bible, Dan McClellan, where he talks about how the house that an average family or community lived in ancient Judea essentially had two rooms. So the upstairs part was where you lived and slept, and the downstairs part was kind of like the entrance space, the kitchen, and where you would keep animals. And we think that the original first century Bible text implies that there was no room upstairs in the bedroom part of the house, and instead Jesus had to be put to sleep downstairs in the kind of more kind of, you know, grotty part of the house.
Right.
So this is where we get this idea from. Yeah. So it's not entirely inaccurate that, you know, Jesus was, you know, born in a manger or a stable, but it is a little different.
Already, year five mark in Sunday schools, mind's being blown. I don't know if you are picking up on that energy. So wait, where did the animals actually come from in the story?
So the Bible is a really complicated book with lots of different parts written by different authors at different times. But one thing that we often forget about today is that there are texts that were thought to be part of the original Bible back in the Middle Ages that were not. And one of them we refer to now as the infancy gospel of Matthew. And this text, or it's sometimes also referred to as the apocryphal Matthew Gospel.
Sounds so backhanded. Oh my God.
It's a text written around the 7th century, and it is not by the prophet Matthew. It's written by someone else pretending to be him.
Pseudo Matthew,
exactly. And in this text, there is a much more detailed version of the Nativity. So this is the text where we get a lot of the details that later medieval Christians, and indeed Christians right through to now, gather most of the details and specificity about what happened at the birth of Christ, even though it's not a canonical text from the original first century Bible.
I want to get into what's different about what the original version was and what Pseudo-Matthew wrote, but can I just ask, why would somebody 700 years after the birth of Christ want to go back and add in more and different details? Like, what do we think might be motivating that?
If only we knew. This is a question that's fascinated historians for centuries, because not only is there a possibility that there is kind of an element of hoax here happening, an element of clout chasing, you know, perhaps saying, I've discovered the long-lost Bible text and it's definitely original, guys, and it's really important and we have a special copy of it. That's a big part of the history of Christianity in a lot of ways. But there's also the idea of the fact that the Bible is not a fixed text. So we have to really rethink the way that we think about holy texts to understand this history, because they are not set in stone. And every time it's retranslated, it changes. So Pseudo-Matthew's version of the Nativity adds in two particular details, which we now are very familiar with, which is the ox and the ass. Don't laugh, Mark.
I didn't. I was being a grown-up. I was raised in a series of big evangelical churches. I feel like I've earned the right to laugh about a lot of this
That's
stuff.
Totally fair. That's totally fair. Yeah. So the ox and the ass were added in this moment. There are oxes and donkeys mentioned in the original Bible in different contexts. They have different symbolism. One interpretation of the symbolism of these animals is that the ox represents the Jews and their sort of purity and nobility, and then the ass or the donkey represents non-Jews in that period as being slightly more base and less noble, but still worthy of God's love and being part of the kingdom of God. So this sort of duality of man is represented in these two animals. The lion is something about the ox and the ass adored the baby Jesus. So the symbolism there is that all of humanity, whether they are believers or non-believers, pagans or Christians or Jews, all love Christ because he's so holy and special.
Okay, so firstly, we have the birth of Christ not in an inn, but actually in a house. Then, 700 years later, some animals are written into the story, an ox and a donkey, to symbolize the notion that both Jew and Gentile can get down with Jesus. Really, little tweaks. But the nativity scene, writ large as we know it, that would take 500 years to develop. And a small trip to Italy.
Well, the number one moment in history that really elevated the idea of the nativity to one of the most important scenes in the Christian imagination happened in 1223.
Great year.
Great year. Banger year.
Banger year.
Banger year.
Where are we in 1223?
We're in a tiny, tiny town called Greccio in Italy. It's about 80 kilometers north of Rome. And it is the site of essentially the first nativity scene.
Oh.
And by nativity scene, I mean that classic style of diorama setup that you might see inside or outside a Catholic church in your neighborhood, where you'll see figurines representing Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, and the ox and the donkey. The first version of this, we believe, comes from 1223 in Greccio. And it was spearheaded by none other than a very, very famous saint called Saint Francis of Assisi. Have you heard of Saint Francis of Assisi?
Yes, I live in an area with lots of Catholic schools. So yeah, I've seen that name around. But I actually don't know very much about Saint Francis.
Well, he's one of the sort of most well-known saints of the Middle Ages, particularly Italian saints of the Middle Ages. He's born wealthy and he decides to reject this wealth. He doesn't appreciate that the medieval church is, you know, in his view, too wealthy and living too comfortable a life. So he takes a vow of poverty and he founds an order, the Franciscan order, which is still a really influential order in the Catholic Church. And this order of monks all live in a vow of poverty and they live to serve their community and to serve God. And he's particularly interested in connecting people with the story of Christ and with religion rather than with money and worldly goods. So one of the ways that he does this is to encourage things like pilgrimages and festivities. He himself goes on a really long pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and he goes to Bethlehem, the site of Christ's birth, actually. He personally, and spiritually, he's deeply connected to the story of the birth of Christ, and he has a lot of passion for it, in fact. From what we know from his biographers, he's in a tiny town called Greccio in 1223, and he has a really good buddy there whose name is Giovanni. This is, you know, all that we know about him, really, from the Chronicles. His name is Giovanni, and he's potentially a soldier or maybe like a nobleman, local man of some means. And St. Francis instructs Giovanni to sort of do an act of devotion to Christ, which involves recreating the scene of his birth. And this recreation, which later on St. Francis gets all of the credit of producing, but it was probably, you know, his friend Giovanni helped him a lot with it. They get together.
Giovanni got done dirty, didn't he? That's the real headline.
Giovanni
here.
Got done dirty, yeah. Giovanni helps him to put on this staged kind of reenactment where they dress up, not them personally, but they have probably a woman dress up as Mary. They have Joseph and they have a wooden, probably a wooden doll or sculpture or effigy of the Christ child. They set it up in a manger-like space and they also bring in an ox and a donkey and they recreate the story of his birth and they do a mass. They pray. It's a big kind of spiritual moment. And this is what we now think is probably the first nativity play or nativity scene.
And a lot of the iconography that we now clearly recognize can be traced back to this moment in 1223, can't it?
Yeah. And also not just the iconography, but the idea of reenactment, of putting on a play or creating a physical reconstruction. You know, it's kind of like LARPing.
Okay, for those of you playing along at home that don't know what LARPing is, it's live action role playing. It's where people dress up like medieval knights. I do think it's worth pointing one thing out. Something amazing, allegedly, happens in that reenactment, does it not?
Well, we have conflicting sources, but there's a number of potential miracles that actually happen around this reenactment. One of them is that it said that the statue of the baby Jesus that they use in this nativity scene cries real tears, which is actually not an uncommon thing that happens in the Middle Ages. Statues crying or bleeding is quite common, actually. Another thing that happens is the straw or hay that they use in this scene is fed to local animals and actually heals sick animals, it's recorded. So there is a sense that performing this scene and conducting a mass at the same time and sort of having St. Francis bless this production almost sort of produces holy and miraculous substances. So there's a real tying of the sort of metaphysical spirituality of thinking about this moment and meditating on it, and then the real physical output of it. So this idea of making the spiritual or the historical real in the present day has real world miraculous consequences for these people. So this no doubt, you know, inspires a lot of other people to produce their own versions of the nativity scene, to meditate on it or to conduct mass in honor of this scene.
And this kicks off a centuries-long obsession with the nativity scene. And it turns out that a lot of the visual tropes that we associate with Christianity today, they actually really go back to the Middle Ages.
And there's a really good reason for this. One is that there is an absolute boom in visual production, in paintings, in sculptures in this period. And this is where we cement kind of cliches and formulas for presenting stories about, say, the life of Christ or the life of the Virgin, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the reasons for this great boom in image production, it's not just that, you know, there's a bit more wealth and material prosperity that produces this. It's also that medieval Christian theology is deeply invested in memory making to use images as memory devices, and not just literal images, but images in the mind. So repeating images and meditating on them, Christians believe the eyes were the window into the soul. Literally, an image could imprint itself into your mind through your eyes, literally imprint. And it was therefore really important to teach the congregation, everyday people, about the stories from the Bible in visual ways, in ways that would impress themselves on their memory. And we actually have this exact phrase, impressing on the memory, in one of the biographies of St. Francis of Assisi in reference to the first nativity scene. It said that when everyone watched it, when they watched the mass, when they participated in the mass with this staged nativity, that it was impressed on their memories.
When you step back, you realise that St. Francis pulled off something really quite remarkably clever by giving Christians a physical tableau of Christ's birth, something to see, to sit with, to pray to. He tapped straight into the architecture of memory itself. You see an image enough times and it doesn't just stick, it starts to shape how you feel and what you believe. And the extraordinary part is that his version, the one he set up in a tiny Italian town, it's pretty much the nativity scene we default to some 800 years later.
The nativity scene is one of the more consistent iconographies of Christianity. It hasn't changed all that much since 1223, when St. Francis put on the first nativity scene. Unlike other stories and other pieces of Christian iconography, which have mutated, I'd say, a little bit more over time, we have, you know, different interpretations of, say, the Last Supper or the crucifixion even. We have versions that show the thieves crucified alongside Christ, versions that don't show that. We have different saints present. We have various different versions of the different scenes from the life of the Virgin Mary. That changes through time, and what's emphasized in those stories change through time too, for political and religious reasons. But the Nativity is one that has stayed pretty much the same since the 13th century. And I think that really is down to the power of Franciscan preaching in that period that really cemented it as the most, I think, the most popular Christian iconography.
So what does it say that this idea cemented itself in the 1200s and we haven't really massively changed it since? What is it about that image that you think has cut through and managed to hold people's attention for hundreds of years?
I think there's something quite universal about the scene of a newborn baby with its family. And I think that makes it quite popular across a lot of demographics. You know, a lot of mothers can identify with it. A lot of fathers can identify with it. We are all babies at some point. And I think we can all kind of meditate, whether we're religious or not, on the miracle of birth and of where we come from in our lives when we look at a picture of the Nativity. A more cynical take is that there's a sense of purity and simplicity to it. It's not very controversial. There hasn't been a lot of religious controversy or political controversy around that scene, save for the whole debate on the virgin birth that we can save for another time.
Oh, that's a whole different thing.
But I think also the fact that it's tied to Christmas, which has become, it wasn't originally, but it has become the most important Christian holiday and festivity in the year's calendar, and is also now, of course, a huge secular holiday. I think it's being tied to Christmas itself has made it endure in a way that other scenes haven't as much.
What do you think the evolution of the Nativity scene tells us about how traditions kind of form and endure?
I think it really shows us that visual cultural history is like one really long game of telephone with centuries of history before us. But at the same time, there can be singular moments in that game of telephone that really take it on an offshoot. So I'm sure you know this, Mark, if you play the game of telephone, especially if you're with a group of people where there's one really rogue participant who will change the entire trajectory of the game. So you might have, you know, five people say pretty much the same thing in the game, and then a sixth person comes in and it takes a completely left turn. I think that's kind of what history is like. I think in a game of telephone, there can be one player who really reshapes the direction that the story is going in. And I think St. Francis of Assisi in 1223 is one of those moments that really was so influential in this long tradition of changing and reshaping and readapting and re-remembering the story of the birth of Christ.
Mary McGillivray, this has been delightful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark, and Merry Christmas.
And to you. Mary McGillivray, art historian there. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. The engineer who did the sound, that's Angie Grant. I'm Mark Fennell, and no one saw it coming. It is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia, for ABC Radio National. We will be back with a brand new episode next week. Until then, goodbye, and Merry Christmas if you choose to partake. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.